weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
And I'm Steve Nesbitt, head of the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences here at the University of Illinois. Our Illinois listeners will be very familiar with today's guest, Tim Colleen, from his time as the president of the University of Illinois system. But what you may not know is that he's also a geophysicist with a long-storied scientific career and is also a faculty member in our department. From 1987 to 2000, he was a professor in the Department of Atmospheric, Oceanic, and Space Sciences at the University of Michigan. He was also the director of the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which we'll talk about today, from 2000 to 2008.
Joining us to talk about his research in atmospheric science and his plans after stepping down as president of the University of Illinois, and a little bit of his thoughts about the current state of climate science in the United States, is President Tim Colleen. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Nice to see you, Maddie.
So we'll go a little bit into your expertise here. So your specialty in atmospheric science is in the upper parts of the atmosphere. We've had interviews on campus here about space weather. So can you tell a little bit about what your research was in space weather and why it's important to the average person?
Okay. Well, maybe a little history of how I got there. I did a PhD in physics, actually particle physics. Couldn't get a job, the next obvious job, but down the corridor there was a group that was working in space physics and doing sounding rocket experiments in the auroral regions in the northern hemisphere. So I did that for a while. That hooked me on space science, particularly on space physics, but generally the upper atmosphere, the ionosphere, magnetosphere, the solar environment and planets as well. I just felt that was enthralling kind of subject, and you can relate it all to planet Earth, which is the platform for all of life. So it seemed like a wonderful field to get into. I was a postdoc in the United Kingdom, and a professor came to see what I was doing and with sounding rockets, and said, well, if you do that with sounding rockets, we would like you to try doing it on a NASA spacecraft mission to the upper atmosphere, to the thermosphere at the time. That, I thought, was a very exciting opportunity. So I came, and I didn't think it was going to be more than about 18 months max, but here I am all these many years later as University of Illinois president. And what we did there was we made some of the first measurements of the global dynamical wind field in the upper atmosphere, the region where satellites, low Earth orbiting satellites, fly. So directly relevant to performance of satellites, how long they reside, how quickly they come back down because of satellite drag, but also a region of the near-Earth environment where you can get significant disturbances from solar storms that can affect everything from GPS to trajectory mapping of satellites. There are obviously national security implications, but also really pragmatic implications of will our electrical grid hold up if there's a major storm from the sun. If it's coming our way, how can we how can we predict it, etc. So they're very practical reasons that you want, with a highly technological, digitally oriented society where we all depend a lot on digital devices of all kinds and information retrieval, etc. Space sciences and space physics directly affects the robustness of that societal system. So it had all the allure, intellectual allure, but also the practical implications. But flying spacecraft on rockets for a young person is pretty exciting. The countdown goes like this: 10, 9, 8, boom. And then it goes up and you think, will that gadget that I just spent years working on survive the shaking of the launch? So it had all of that sort of drama and excitement as well as everything else. So it was a good profession, a good research arena to be in. And those kind of experimental skills, and then the observational skills, the data analytical skills, led to theoretical work as well on supercomputers, where you try to understand what you're seeing. You got through the evidence of remote sensing, et cetera. And so I worked, I became the director of the Space Physics Research Lab at University of Michigan, and we had satellite missions to Venus and Mars and, you know, Jupiter and so forth. And we were on Cassini, which flew through the rings of Saturn and then took a picture looking back towards the sun. Very exciting stuff. So I can't complain about my career at all.
And what are some projects in the current state of the field? What are some space weather projects that you'd love to see get funded?
Well, I think there's a lot of more international participation right now in the satellite arena. Obviously, these networks of fleets of satellites that do radio telecommunications, et cetera, are populating the region that I was studying in. So I think the stability of that is really, really important. The future role of satellite communications with quantum is going to be something that I think is really coming of age very quickly. As you know, University of Illinois is working in quantum computing, and part of the rationale for that is quantum computers can very quickly de-encrypt things, and they can do calculations of very complex geophysical situations and give results very quickly. But the ability to do that anywhere in the world is going to rely on satellite-to-satellite communications rather than ground-based fiber optics necessarily. So that's, I think, an important arena where I really would like to see University of Illinois play a leading role as well in not just quantum computing, quantum communications, quantum sensing, and connect it with the sort of ethical guidelines, frankly, that are needed for these kind of new technologies coming to play. And I think the role of a university like ours, where you have all of the intersecting disciplines, is really important, because, you know, big industry have their own rationales, governments have their own rationales, but I think we have the intellectual capacity to take some leadership role for that. So I think the space arena is going to be very vibrant, because we're depending on it more and more technologically. And, you know, I hope it never comes to pass that there's kind of conflict in the space environment, that it still becomes, you know, remains a place of stability and equanimity and peace, so that, you know, satellites don't get shot out of the sky. So it's been that way for now, but I think we need to be cautious about the advance of technology in all of these fronts. My own field has been in remote sensing. So in fact, I've got a satellite in orbit as we speak, operating as we speak, with four telescopes. At least it was last time I looked, which is about a month ago, so I hope it hasn't been turned off. It's been up there for about 22 years, and it's measuring the composition, wind, and temperature structure of the what we call the mesosphere and lower thermosphere, which is a little bit lower than my original work, a little higher than weather work, but in that intermediate part of the atmosphere, too high for balloons and too low for satellites. So we used to jocularly call it the ignorosphere, because it was very hard to make direct in-situ measurements. So the satellite that's up there now is making those observations. And those are important observations, too, to really fully understand the dynamics and the structure of the planet that we live on.
As Tim's very familiar with, our field relies on NCAR as sort of the beehive of activity for many things, from theory models, societal applications, and workforce development even. Really, the NCAR, which you were the director of from 2000 to 2008, is a very important center that ties together a lot of different parts of our field. In a nutshell, can you describe NCAR and why it's important to the United States?
Yeah, so NCAR was formed to support universities across the country that had atmospheric science departments and were unable to each instrument themselves adequately to take on the really tricky nonlinear problems. So NCAR was created in the early 60s, that time frame, as a place that would develop the kind of leading edge facilities that all of these universities could tap into and take advantage of. I think it's now over 100 and maybe even 120 universities who are members of the NCAR, UCAR system. So it was created for multidisciplinary work, the kind of work I was just talking about, to provide one-of-a-kind facilities that would be too expensive for individual universities to manage and to support. So NCAR did become the beehive. I think that's it became the place where you could develop high-performance nonlinear models of the Earth system in all of its complexity: Earth, biosphere, atmosphere, oceans, etc., and really build the capabilities there in support of the university community. And the professors at all these universities, and University of Illinois was a founding university for NCAR, one of the original founders, and benefited from that enormously in terms of access to facilities that were then managed on behalf of the whole national community with a free and open opportunity. Now, it was funded by NSF, so an investigator would have to write a proposal to NSF to get access to the NCAR facilities, and that's how it operated, and very effective in terms of building that capacity, and really state-of-the-art, world-leading knowledge base for not just computation, but radar observations, satellite observations, balloon observations, global observations of extreme weather impact events, hurricanes, tornadoes, etc. NCAR developed some of the really important technologies that enabled weather forecasting to be as good as it is these days.
The cold here today. Today, some sun, some flurries still possible. It's windy out there right now. Tomorrow morning is when we expect.
The heaviest snow is going to fall from noon today all the way through 8 p.m. And so that it is going to be a really nice afternoon. That is, if you don't mind the windy conditions. And we will.
Now, people laugh about weather forecasting not being perfect, but the precision of the forecasts have increased over decades to a point where we all rely on them. And, industry relies on them, transportation relies on them, et cetera. All of that has been driven by the fact that the whole national community said we need to have a place that can deliver the world-class facilities that we all need, and it's got to be accessible to all. That's been a very, very successful model in this arena of, I would say, space science as well. I mean, pioneering work was done on sunspots and on coronal physics and on solar storms. Pioneering work on wildfires, handheld devices that can help a firefighter out in the field know what might happen in terms of maybe it could be an outbreak to the left or to the right or something. So that means life-saving capabilities. And then many thousands of young investigators coming through and going back and teaching their students, in those universities. So it's been a huge success story, I think, for U.S. science, and it's put the U.S. at the forefront of the knowledge about how the metabolism of planet Earth interacts and why it is the way it is, how weather works to move surplus energy to deficit energy regions, what's happening in the Earth's oceans, etc. So I often think that the Greeks had it right. The word geology is Earth wisdom, right? Geologos. I think so. We need wisdom about this is the one planet that supports all of our lives, right, our livelihoods, etc. So we need to understand it as best we can. NCAR's been at the cutting edge of that for decades. And so I think it's a very important nodal location. And, of course, it's internationally renowned. So I was honored to be the director there for 8 years. We built new supercomputers, IBM machines, etc. We kept the pace with the evolving technologies, participated in lots of major studies of extreme weather events and climate change and oceanic change, wildfires, droughts, floods, you name it, and also increasingly the human dimensions of that. How does society make decisions on the basis of that kind of understanding and knowledge? And how will the next generation of weather forecast systems that you dial into, right, every morning probably, how can they be improved and can benefit, you know, decision making capacities for society writ large. So it's that important.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the weekly podcast about climate and weather. We are joined by University of Illinois President Tim Colleen to talk about his research in atmospheric science and his thoughts on the current state of climate science in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, weather impacts almost everybody directly, but also our economy. It's in tens of billions of dollars.
And
have a resilient economy, it can lead to a lot of disruption.
And it's not easy physics, chemistry, or biology, because it's a nonlinear system, right? There's chaotic activity and the atmosphere finds ways to move energy around, and everything's intensifying right now. I mean, in my lifetime, the sea surface temperature of the tropical ocean has gone up a degree Celsius or more, and that's like a lot of evaporation, a lot of latent energy pumped into the atmosphere. It's got to go somewhere, and so we need to understand, you know, what's going to happen, the likelihood of that, with a degree of precision that can influence good decision making in terms of infrastructure provision, in terms of robustness of transportation networks, buildings. So it's directly relevant to the way our society functions.
So, unfortunately, the Trump administration has recently announced its plans to dismantle NCAR.
The Trump administration says it plans to dismantle the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado, which is the nation's premier atmospheric science center.
The facility hosts 7 labs in Boulder, and according to science.org, 830 people work here, and we don't yet know exactly how they will all be impacted.
What are your thoughts on current efforts to preserve the center, and do you think they'll be successful?
That's a timely question. There is a move to dismantle, is the word used by OMB, the Office of Management Budget, in the Trump administration. And it's not clear to me yet which pieces would move and where they would move and how it would function. So the optimist in me says this is not necessarily a closing of the scientific capabilities of the United States in this important arena that's only gaining in importance. Institutions do need to evolve, so I'm open-minded to, you know, it could be made better, etc. But I have written letters detailing how the contributions, why the contributions are important, and how they're not just in the area of climate change prediction, but in all these other areas that I mentioned a moment ago. So I'm very hopeful that the university community and the business community will kind of look at this and say, well, we need that function. You want to rename it? Maybe, but we need the function to support and you mentioned the workforce development aspects of it too. That's incredibly important. The next generations are going to confront issues and problem sets that we haven't had before. So they need the tool base and the toolkit to be able to understand, to mitigate, to adapt, to be, you know, to create a continually robust society where you know, economic prosperity can be guaranteed for the future, for the future of our kids and their kids, etc. That is dependent on knowledge of the environmental stresses that are coming at us, and there are lots of them, and they're going to show up in not linear ways always. So we need a sophisticated understanding of this, and the United States has to stay in the intellectual leadership, absolutely. It can't become a second tier, third tier to understanding the way in which the planet Earth functions and how it relates to humanity. That's a big kind of question right there.
So, Tim, following your time at NCAR, you went to National Science Foundation in Washington.
Yes.
And you were the assistant director for geosciences there, obviously a very important funding agency that helps coordinate research at universities and also at NCAR. Recently, NSF has had its own challenges. I have friends that were summarily kicked out of their office with very little notice. The NSF headquarters was switched to a different agency. Why is NSF important and as a bedrock sort of supporting science? And what are your thoughts on the current state of NSF and what it should do next?
Well, NSF is an incredibly important, uniquely important agency for the United States. It created and developed in the post-war years to basically ensure that we were at the cutting edge of new knowledge in all fields, physics, chemistry, biology, et cetera, social sciences, engineering, and it's performed that job admirably for decades now, leading to many Nobel Prizes, many great discoveries, again, the educational attainments of generations of people. So National Science Foundation, I really honor that agency, and I was there for 4 years, and I was the assistant director for the geosciences, as you mentioned. So we had Earth, ocean, space, we had land masses as well, seismology. So when the Haiti earthquake happened, NSF went into action to ensure that we would be better prepared should there be further earthquakes that could damage buildings and human lives. So it's had, when the oil spill happened, I was there, and it was NSF that went out and actually made the observations that figured out where the oil was coming from, how much was there, and how, you know, in many ways could be cleaned up. So NSF is fundamentally important to the intellectual vitality of the country and the technological capabilities. And I could go on and on and on about computation, engineering. Of course, my arena was the Earth system sciences. And yes, it's going through a patch now that's tricky and difficult. There was the first year led to, you know, multiple agencies being directly affected with the new administration, and NSF was not immune from that. I was encouraged to see the budget that was came from the Congress and passed by the president had NSF's budget decremented by only a few percent, maybe 3%, which is more of a haircut than a amputation. And now we'll see how that all works through. But again, it's fundamental to the the United States. We have 4.5% of the world's population, so we've got to live off our wits. We've got to be operating at the intellectual cutting edge. And when I first went to NSF, I remember the deputy director there told me, I think he probably told this to everybody, is if you're operating, if your research is at the leading edge, the forward hemisphere is not gray, it's black. Because you're really probing the unknown of what is not known yet. So the United States has to do that because, new knowledge is central to future prosperity and future economic development, and all kinds of things flow from that, livelihoods, discernment in decision-making. It's all really incredibly important. So again, I'm a fierce proponent of the National Science Foundation and the other scientific agencies, and have worked extensively with them, but with NASA, as I mentioned, with the Department of Energy, NOAA, all of these agencies are really incredibly important to the intellectual vitality, but also the economic competitiveness of the United States. It's derived essentially from our ability to design, to create, to be entrepreneurial, to innovate extensively, and all of that is jeopardized if you kind of unravel things that have proved their worth over time. Now, I'm not, you know, proposing that we don't consider the future carefully. You know, institutions can evolve; they should evolve. Modern times are different; things are changing rapidly. But the National Science Foundation is like bedrock for the competitive positioning of the United States, which we're all vested in. Yeah.
And so, kind of we're seeing some changes, potential disruptions to some of these more national scientific agencies. Where does that leave the role in the of the university, kind of in this overall scientific enterprise?
That's a question that's very much on my mind, because we have a wonderful university here. It's called the University of Illinois System, three universities. We just passed the 100,000 student mark, so we now have 101,000 students. The enrollments have been growing. Research is vibrant and has been growing. Our support from our alumni has been growing too. So that's the question I ask myself almost every day. What is our appointed role in terms of projecting into a healthy future for society? Okay, so we call ourselves in our university the public's university. We're of the public. We belong to the public, right? We're a university in a state. We benefit enormously from good alignment with state decision makers and strong public trust and confidence in us. And it's because we've kept our costs down, I believe. We've made our world-class educational opportunities attainable, affordable to the people of Illinois. I think we need to lead even more into the future. Lead by helping shape, not by being sort of look at us and send us more money because you have to believe us, right? Those discussions and arguments have to be replaced by, look, we support societal function, and we do it by creating world-class educational that's accessible, can be attained. It's not so costly that you know, 41% of our students who graduate don't have any debt. That's a large, it's not quite half, but that's significant. So we want to do good things for society, and I feel like we need to lead more than maybe has been true in the past, because government is always worried about the next election. Industry, big industry is worried about the quarterly, you know, bottom line and the stakeholders, et cetera. And the U.S. has a special role to play in innovation and invention that has done for many decades, hundreds of years. So the role of the public, I would say even the land-grant universities, which are rooted and grounded in place, and they were designed to lift society up. So we have to do that really well, and we have to exercise leadership in that too. Quantum is one arena, but we've got to bring the arts and humanities into that arena as well. It's not like you can leave pieces out. And we're one of the few places, these kinds of universities are one of the few places where you can convene expertise across all of the disciplines pertinent and germane to a problem set and attack that problem set with a public good emphasis, right? This is not about fame, fortune, prestige. It's about actually lifting the boats in the harbor. There's another metaphor going off in a direction. But I think leading is, that's very much on my mind now. How do we lead without, building bonfires of the vanities and, you know, things like, you know, that would be distracting, but substantively important for the times in history in which we're embedded. And I'm very proud of the way we're stepping up to that at the University of Illinois. And that kind of intellectual leadership has to come with recognition that you can't do it all in one institution. Even such a thing as NCAR, as well endowed as it's been, cannot do it all. It had to partner. So partnering is incredibly important too. So authentic partnerships where you can roll your sleeves up and say, hey, we think this is important to work on together. Those things can move the dial rapidly. So it's a very interesting time to be a university president of such a place, tell you the truth. Yeah, pinch myself every morning, yeah.
So switching gears a little bit back into climate and sustainability, something very near and dear to your heart, having written a book recently on the topic and arranging for the Sustainability Congress last summer in Chicago, which was a great success. One of the things that sort of ties some of this together is that research itself is becoming more intensive with the rise of AI, data centers, and everything else. Mm-hmm. And so how does the U of I maintain its level of sustainability, but despite the fact that research is going to become more carbon intensive in the future?
Oh, well, we have to work towards a carbon less intensive future. There's no question about that. You know, having been teaching these things for decades. You can take a lot of things on in life, but you can't take on the second law of thermodynamics. It's going to be there no matter what you do. So we have to move towards a low carbon economy, and the university has to model that as well. And we have plans to do that, to move in those directions. We just working on micronuclear as an option as well, which would be perhaps as much as 25% of the load of the big data centers are going to consume a lot of. We need to worry a lot about the carbon intensity of that brave new world as well. I think one of our alums is the CEO of Bloom Energy. That's part of that solution, and very interested in seeing how that lowering of the carbon intensity for data centers can start to move forward more effectively. And I actually prefer the word, it's a mouthful, thrivability to sustainability, because sustainability as a term has become a little politically suspect in certain quarters. And if you take its literal meaning, it means that you can preserve some status, right? Some level. It could be a miserable status that gets preserved. It could be the Blade Runner movie, like forever, if you've seen that.
Yes.
So I like the word thrivability because it implies that it's going to be a future that is going to be one to enjoy for our progeny as they come forward. So I think that's, universities like ours can play a leading role, particularly by partnering with other like institutions. So we're partnering with Brazil. We're partnering with Mexico. We're partnering in Southeast Asia, Singapore, in India. We're partnering in Europe in, significant partnerships where I would say sustainability is one of the common themes. Cybersecurity is another common theme. Energy utilization, healthcare delivery, inequities in healthcare outcomes, another common theme. We should be working on all of the above. And I do think that AI is going to be an important tool to assess, to take some of the sort of drudgery out of building these knowledge bases, but you still have to have the human being, the expert there as well. Have we figured all this out? We're in the thick of it. We're living in historical times.
So you alluded to U of I's plan to reach carbon neutrality. The plan is to reach carbon neutrality by 2050. What elements of this plan are you particularly excited about? And then what elements do you find maybe a little more challenging?
Well, it's non-trivial, the whole thing about, transportation, buildings, smart buildings, keeping people warm in the winter, cool in the summer. All of these things are non-trivial, but we have expertise in all of the above. It's going to be a multifaceted approach. There's no single silver bullet, I don't think. I do think, as a physicist, both of us, I do think safe nuclear is going to come back significantly, quickly, because the small modular reactors can be put up, I gather, in a few years, 3 years, and so we want to be at a leading edge of that kind of thing. We're working with a company that's got an idea of 700 of these things. So cruise ships can have them, data centers can have them, et cetera. So nuclear will be a part of it. Renewables is already a major part of it. The costs have come way down. The costs of renewables have come down faster than anybody was predicting 15 years ago when I was, teaching in class and stuff. So I think that's part of it. Decarbonizing, is going to be like a hallmark of the next 20 years. And there are going to be jobs in that arena that will come to the fore. It's important that we educate the right kind of people who can drive that push forward. It's going to become increasingly obvious that we have to do it. So it may feel like we're in full reverse, but I just hope that we don't go from crisis to crisis, that we use our engineering base, our physical understanding, our knowledge of economics and of decision making appropriately to move quickly into a lower carbon future. There's going to be a long tail of that, but we've got to get it down quickly at this stage.
So kind of on the global stage to kind of get this carbon emissions down, the Paris Agreement is a landmark international treaty adopted in 2015 with the goal of limiting global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. The Trump administration has pulled out of the Paris Agreement. Kind of given this, what role does the U of I have to play in these international climate agreements like the Paris Agreement?
Well, we're not at the table for the international treaty agreements necessarily, but at the sustainability conference, for example, we had business meetings of the Sustainable Development Network, SDSN, which works closely with the United Nations on the so-called SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, that were put forward 20 years ago or something like that, that have been very instrumental in leading to the 2 degree kind of outlook that you alluded to. So I think in that arena, which is very influential international partnering, we can play a significant role in convening, such as we did this last summer. In fact, we also hosted the Aspen Climate Institute this last summer. So for summer of 2025, Chicago, Illinois, was the epicenter of solutions for these kind of issues that you're talking about. We've got to continue doing that, getting the best ideas, transmitting them, writing the books as needed with the right kind of evidence-based sort of analysis that's going to be important, and working with industry and working with private sector more effectively. They need to convert the knowledge of impacts to business plans. Then, the scientific community cannot stand to one side and say, well, that's your problem. We've got to work with the business community to say, this is how you can utilize this kind of information, these kind of predictions, this kind of understanding to further your business plans that you need for a continuation of your. That, I think, is coming to age. I think that's coming into play really quickly. We are convening multiple groups of foundations and business communities. I'm working closely with the World Business Chicago organization, for example, now on sustainability. So that's, they've got many, many thousands, perhaps, of companies that are all conversant with these kind of questions. They need components of their business plans. It's got to be converted to an actionable kind of approach for them, because they can't work in the abstract normally. So we got to do a better job, I think, in academia of translating the research into bite-sized pieces that can be converted quickly to effective devices, products, supplies, services that are meaningful for the business sector. That's exciting. We can lead that in this country. We can lead that in the Midwest. So we got to take the lead. It's getting back to this question of how do you lead? And I think this leadership includes partnering with the private sector significantly, the governmental sector as well, provide good advice. Partnering internationally is something I feel very strongly about. I think we've done that historically. There's a great legacy of those kind of partnerships internationally, University of Illinois, with globalization in terms of trades and tariffs and things fraying a little bit at the edges, it's time to recommit to what I'm calling intellectual globalization, where you're problem solving and working across country and disciplinary boundaries. And that's inspiring to the youth as well. So it's all part of the same thing. How do you lift the youth up? You don't do it by separating yourself from the action. You do it by flooding in and with solutions.
So, Tim, you've had a remarkable tenure here at the University of Illinois, and I think many faculty, if I may speak on their behalf, we're very sad to see that you may be leaving us in 2027. Can you talk about a little bit your plans after stepping down?
Well, not in huge detail. I can tell you it's a subject of conversation with my wife and family. I will have been president for 12 years at that time, which is like a long time. In fact, I was Googling around or whatever, ChatGPTing around, saying, long-serving university presidents. There aren't many who served that long. It's been a remarkable honor for me to be in this role. And we have momentum. I really think on every objective metric of the University of Illinois, we're doing well. Enrollment, philanthropy, reputation, research, quality, facilities, you know, we're making progress on all the fronts and doing it in a way that combines excellence and scale. So I'm very proud of that. I don't take any credit for it because my family's motto is shed the credit. Don't tell my kids that. They'd roll their eyes. At some point it ends, right? I really would like to be, for the transition to be dignified, graceful, no full of drama, no like pyrotechnics, et cetera. No, will, he won't, he, who knows, jockeying, you know what I mean? Because you do see that in other universities. So we want a role model, grace in transition. At least I do. So help me with that. Now, what am I going to do next? You know, when people say, congratulations on your retirement, I take the word congratulations. Retirement is a word I can't, like, digest. I can't digest it. I'm just like, how could I ever stop or slow down? I just don't know how that would work. I joke, but don't take this wrong. I don't know one end of a golf stick from the other. So, I have to keep working and contributing in something that I feel passionate about and important about. And I've got, I'm having some conversations about what that might be. It won't be running a huge multi-university campus, but it'll be along the lines of the kinds of things we've been emphasizing in terms of youth development, planning for the future, thrivability rather than sustainability. I think those are things I feel are important.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the weekly podcast about climate and weather. We are joined by University of Illinois President Tim Colleen to talk about his research in atmospheric science and his thoughts on the current state of climate science in the United States. So, looking back on your tenure, what are some highlights or accomplishments that you are most proud of?
Well, I think the topic that comes to my mind is the topic of providing a world-class education at an affordable price for lots of people. It's not easy to keep your costs down because every department, every college, every building, you know, a lot of these deferred maintenance building in the, built in the 70s, you know, but the board has been very supportive of the impetus we have to make our educational opportunity attainable. And we've grown by 25,000 students from the day I started. That's like adding another big university, right? So we've grown, but without any diminishment of excellence and quality. That I'm proud of. That may be hard to quantify. People will say, what's he talking about? But I'm proud of that because young people need that opportunity. And we've been able to do that, I think, over a 10-year period with a lot of challenges along the way. Oh, I'm also proud of COVID. I mean, the work that this university did for COVID, best in the world, saving lives, many, many lives, many neighbors who are alive now who would have and we did that generously as well. We developed the IP, we gave it away to the world. It was in every school in the state of Illinois. It allowed parents to stay working while if there was one kid sick in a classroom, everything stopped, the parents had to stop work. Test to stay was something that was developed. So I'm proud of that response to a global crisis as well. Oh, there are lots of things I'm very, very proud of. The team that's here is remarkable. The people of the University of Illinois system are just remarkable. And so remarkable, actually, that a bunch of them have left to become presidents elsewhere. I asked my chief of staff, how many people have we lost to presidencies or provostships? She said 19. So the talent pool here is remarkable. I think we've weathered a lot. of issues. You know, budget. There was a budget deficit, a budget impasse, I would say. There was a pandemic, and now these changes of the federal landscape are very significant.
Any specific plans for the remainder of your time?
Yeah, my foot is hovering over the accelerator, not the brake. We're working hard on a lot of fronts. I think obviously AI and quantum, you all know about that. Mm-hmm. That's like a once in a generation opportunity. DPI has been training like 5,000 young people to get, you know, kind of technical jobs of the future. That's very exciting. We're just, you know, expanding that in Chicago. You see cranes in the air here. You know, there's scaffolding around the union. There's a new building. We just opened the computer building in Chicago, and there's a drug discovery pavilion going up and in UIS. So we're modernizing the physical infrastructure of the three universities. We've got three wonderful chancellors who are working well together, and they're like a formidable force, and I mean that in the most positive way. We are not going to slow down at all. People talk about a victory lap. I react the same way I do with the word retirement. Not for me. That's not like my style. So there'll be plenty of time to celebrate accomplishments, but there's work to be done. There's definitely work to be done. And our applications are going up again for next fall. We had another round of constrained tuition. I'm going to go to the governor's speech next week on the state budget. We're recruiting faculty. We got a lot of deferred maintenance to worry about, huge amount of elderly buildings that need some work done. And then we've got to work on this trust and confidence of the public, which means we've got to be out and about, and we have to be authentic and participatory on all of these fronts. So I think that all takes energy and commitment, so I'm not going to let up personally, and my team won't either. Yeah, I know that.
Well, Tim, on that note, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for all the questions.
Tim Killeen is the president of the University of Illinois System. For those just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover.
And I'm Steve Nesbitt.
Have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. Weather Realness is produced by
Jeff Frame,
Trent Ford,
Steve Nesbitt,
Reginald Hardwick,
and myself, Maddie Stover. Funding for this podcast is partially provided by the Backlund Charitable Trust. Weather Realness is produced by the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media. We'll talk with you again next week.